Welcome, welcome to the Deathcast.
We have determined that there has been a 44 caliber revolver used in every one of them, which is why, as the mayor mentioned, it's important that any person having information with respect to anyone who is in possession of a 44 caliber revolver call us.
We're dealing with mega serial killer.
5 times since last summer. His victims, mostly young women. Fear has spread in this city. Streets and residential areas are deserted late at night.
This is a police sketch of a suspect. The killer police are looking for is called the 44 caliber killer because of the weapon he has used.
In a neighborhood of the Bronx called Pelham Bay and in Forest Hills near the famous tennis club, the killer has struck 6 times since last summer, and 5 are dead. Most of them pretty young women. Shot at close range on the sidewalk or in parked cars. 18-year-old Donna Loria was the first, killed last July. Then,
Good evening. David Berkowitz, 24 years old, a postal worker, walked out of his Yonkers apartment last night, turned the ignition key in his car, and found himself surrounded by police. Well, he said, you got me. Police say those words ended the biggest manhunt in New York City history with the capture of Son of Sam.
After more than 13 months of following thousands of leads down endless blind alleys, the detectives of the Brooklyn Omega Squad, part of that 300-cop 44 killer manhunt, captured the man they say is Son of Sam. The ice-cold trail heated up suddenly during the past week. A Brooklyn woman who saw a car parked illegally and occupied by a strange-looking man moments before she heard the shots of the last Son of Sam attack, finally contacted police.
The man came towards me, and he looked me straight in the face. He looked at my dog, and right here, we crossed each other. So he had his arm straight down. He had a long thing, like a bell, sticking up his sleeve. And he made a left turn. I heard a boom.
Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I'm your host, best-selling independent author Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me once again. We're moving on to a new case this week after 6 weeks covering the Atlanta child murders. As I'm sure you can tell from listening to the opening, we are going to be covering the Son of Sam. Now, this might be one episode, it might be multiple episodes, I am not certain yet. It all depends on how detailed I feel like getting as I get rolling. This is a pretty fascinating case as far as shooters go. Generally, they tend to be fairly dull and bland, as is the case with the Zodiac Killer. But there are aspects of this case that make it interesting, as Maury Terry discovered. So, yes, if you're not into the whole, you know, there was a cult behind this aspect of the case, you might want to turn it off, because I am going down that road, as the evidence points to all of that. But before I really get into it, we have our normal plugs. If you would like to follow me on social media, you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and MeWe at Ian Totten Author. I do post about these cases on those websites, with MeWe being my preferred haunt, as they don't arbitrarily censor things on their platform. If you would like to help support the production of this show, there's two ways you can do that. There is a Patreon page at Ian Totten Author. You can also find me on PayPal and Venmo if you'd like to make a one-time donation to help with the production of this show. Both of those places you can find me at Ian Totten. Any help is greatly appreciated. If you enjoy the show, please like and subscribe wherever it is you get your podcasts. If they allow you to, such as on Apple Podcasts, leave a review. 5-star reviews help the show grow. And share it on social media. Those are simple, free ways that you can help with the show. And to those of you who do, I greatly appreciate it. One other plug before we dive into it this week. If you're into, you know, gothic horror art that's, you know, I'm going to call risque, check out a good friend of mine, Grim Trickster, on Patreon. She puts out a lot of good content. Again, it's not suitable for work. There is some nudity in her photographs, but it's not what I would classify as pornography. Again, that's Grim Trickster. She really does put out some cool stuff. Now that the plugs are out of the way, get yourself something to drink. Sit down in a chair, relax, close your eyes. I have my coffee, I have my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. Before we take a look at the crimes attributed to the Son of Sam, we need to take a quick look at New York City in the 1970s. Anybody who is familiar with the movie Death Wish with Charles Bronson understands that New York City was not this, you know, clean utopian mecca world destination that they try and present it as being today. It was a city on the brink of collapse with burned out tenements, a very high number of property crimes, and an even higher number of violent crimes. You couple that with a police force that was demonstrably corrupt, and you've got a melting pot of just awful. And this would peak in the mid to late 1980s, but it was so bad back in the 70s in New York that people would often joke about the Rotten Apple, as New York has the nickname of the Big Apple. And that's not a bad comparison, because New York really was a rotten place to live and work. Personal opinion, it's still a shithole. I lived there for a year in 1999, and you couldn't get me to go back to New York if you put a gun in my head. There's just absolutely nothing appealing about it. The streets are scummy. The people are rude and disconnected from reality. They're all doing their own thing. You could get stabbed in front of them, and more chances than not, people are just going to walk around you. And I say this because I saw a lot of things like that in New York when I lived there. Now they try and project this wholesome, you know, family image, but the truth remains that there's still a really high crime rate in New York. And the people that run the city will try and say, oh, it's gotten better, it's gotten better. There's no way to really prove that, as it's been shown in other cities that when they want to change the violent crime statistics that the FBI puts out on a yearly basis, they just don't report the crimes. The New York cities of the 1970s, though, were a absolute nightmare. Mob hits, gang activity, drugs were really starting to take hold in the Harlem area with Frank Lucas. You want a really good view of what New York was honestly like in the 70s, again, referring back to the Charles Bronson movie Death Wish, just look at the locations of that film and see how run down and just gross and unappealing it all was. The parks were filled with trash and graffiti. It just overall had this grimy atmosphere of despair to it. the first of what became known as the 44 caliber or Son of Sam killings took place in the early morning hours of July 29th, 1976 at approximately 1:10 a.m. 18-year-old Donna Lorio, an emergency medical technician, and her friend Jody Valente, who was a 19-year-old nurse, were sitting in Valente's double-parked blue and white Oldsmobile in the Pelham Bay area of the Bronx. Now, Loria's parents, who had been out at a wake, passed the two girls on their way into the apartment and stopped long enough to let their daughter know that she shouldn't be out too much longer as she had to get up in the morning. Donna and Jody continued talking about their evening, which they had spent at the Peachtree, which was a discotheque in New Rochelle. Eventually, Donna said goodnight to Jody and turned to open the car door. As she was opening it, Donna noticed a young man standing on the curb, roughly 8 feet away towards the rear of the car. Donna is supposed to have said something to the effect of, "Now what is this?" At this point, the man pulled a gun from a brown paper bag that he was carrying, and taking the gun in both hands in a shooter's position, crouched down and fired 3 shots into the vehicle. One round hit Donna in the elbow as she threw her hands up to, block out what was happening, and the bullet traveled up her arm, exiting out near her wrist, after which it entered her back and killed her instantly. Donna's body fell from the car into the roadway. Jody Valente was hit in the thigh with one round, and the other bullet that was fired missed. At this point, the killer turned and walked casually away from the crime scene towards Bure and Mayflair Avenues. Neighbors noticed the sound of a car horn blaring, and Rose Loria, Donna's mother, looked out the window into the street below and saw Jody crawling from the car. Donna's father, Mike Loria, was in the stairwell of their apartment with the family dog when he heard the shots. He raced outside and heard Jody screaming, "Donna, Donna." As stated a moment ago, Donna Loria died on scene. Jody Valente, however, survived, and the description that she gave of her attacker is as follows: white male, 30s, 5'9", 160 pounds, curly dark hair, mod style, clean shaven, light complexion, wearing a blue polo shirt with white stripes, dark pants. At the time of the Loria Valente shooting, unfortunately, it was just chalked up to another random murder. The one thing that this case had going for it is that, unlike in a lot of other states, at that time, the homicide detectives in New York City solely focused on homicides. They didn't do burglary cases or anything of that nature. They were strictly there to deal with murders, which should give you some idea as to the level of murders that were taking place in New York at that period. They were able to glean few bits of evidence from this shooting. One thing that they learned was that a strange man had been seen tooling around in the neighborhood in a light yellow car, and that he had also been seen parked in this yellow car down the block from where the shooting took place. Another thing they learned was that Jody didn't recognize her killer. She said he was a complete random stranger. And they also found out that the gun used was a .44 caliber Bulldog, which was a fairly rare gun in New York City at that period of time. But beyond that, there wasn't a whole lot for them to sink their teeth into. Again, that was the nature of New York City in the 1970s. Nothing happened in the case for months. Again, at this point, the police didn't even realize what they had on their hands. The shooting and murder was just that, a shooting and murder. They happen all the time in New York City. On Saturday, October 23rd, at roughly 1 a.m. to 1:15, 18-year-old Rosemary Keenan, who was the daughter of a New York City Police Department detective, and Carl De Niro, a 20-year-old former department store record salesman and security guard at Citibank, left a bar in Flushing, Queens called Peck's. There are a lot of interviews out there with Carl De Niro. He's actually a pretty fascinating guy who I'd love to interview at some point if the opportunity arose. He has stated on a number of occasions that he and Rosemary had hooked up on a few different occasions, and this night was no different from any other, with the exception of De Niro was getting ready to go into the Air Force. Now, the two of them drove off into the night and parked near the corner of 159th Street and 33rd Avenue. The two of them sat in Keenan's Volkswagen Bug for a few minutes, apparently just passing the time before Rosemary's curfew arrived. They noticed a single jogger pass behind them while they sat speaking. At roughly 1:30 a.m., the car's windows exploded inward as someone opened fire on their vehicle. The two of them ducked out of the way of the flying glass as well as the bullets. One bullet landed in the speedometer, pegging it at 30, while others just tore through the vehicle. One bullet struck De Niro in the back of the head, at which point he screamed for Rosemary to get them out of here. And Rosemary, amazingly, was able to get the car started and take off from their parking spot. Understandably, the two of them were shaken and in shock. And in short order, Rosemary was able to get them back over to Peck's bar. Now, I've heard a couple different stories as to what happened next, but what basically happened is the two of them entered the bar, and either De Niro collapsed and he was noticed to have been shot, or somebody noticed the blood pouring from the back of his head and they called the hospital. Regardless, Carl De Niro ended up at the hospital and having a steel plate embedded in the back of his head, which, unfortunately for him, disbarred him from military service. Rosemary Keenan escaped the attack unharmed beyond, you know, psychological damage. The police noted that it almost seemed as though the attacker didn't know what they were doing, wasn't used to handling the caliber of gun that they were using, because they kind of sprayed the vehicle wildly. Although they did learn that a .44 caliber handgun had been used in the shooting. As in the Loria Valente shooting, the case went cold fairly quickly, which again is indicative of New York City in the 70s. Shortly after midnight on November 27, 1976, 16-year-old high school student Donna DeMasi and her friend 18-year-old Joanne Lomino arrived at Lomino's home in the Floral Park area of Queens after seeing a movie in Midtown Manhattan. as the two of them were talking, Donna noticed a man as he came down the sidewalk and strode across the grass towards them before halting roughly 8 feet from the girls. Now, Joanne must have noticed something change in her friend's demeanor as she'd been standing with her back towards the sidewalk, and she turned around at this point, and what they saw was an individual who was roughly 5 feet 8, 150 to 160 pounds, wearing a three-quarter length coat that was reminiscent of an army fatigue jacket. Now, some reports listed that he was decked out in camo. I haven't seen anything that states this to be the case. There is a big difference between a green army coat and fatigues. The man quickly began talking to the girls, who, and they assumed that he was lost, as he spoke in a very high-pitched voice and said, "Can you tell me how to get?" At this point, the man pulled a revolver from his coat and began firing. Joanne, who was still standing with her back to the assailant and had turned to look back at him, was hit in the spinal cord with one shot that continued on into her lung. Donna, who was standing on the lower step of the house, was hit next as she dove to get away from the gunfire. The bullet entered the base of her neck and missed her spine by, you know, fractions of an inch. With both girls lying in the bushes in front of the house, the attacker continued firing, spraying the front of the house and smashing out one of the living room windows, before fleeing down 262nd Street toward 81st Avenue. This was according to a witness who heard the shots and ran outside and watched as the individual hurried away, carrying the gun in his left hand. This is an important thing to remember as, if I'm not mistaken, Berkowitz, the man who would eventually be convicted for the shootings, was right-handed. And generally speaking, when you are carrying a gun, you carry it in the hand that you use to shoot with. Fortunately, both Donna and Joanne survived the attack, although Joanne would be a paraplegic as a result of her injuries and would be forced to spend the rest of her days in a wheelchair. None of the cases were connected at this point, although three sketches were drawn up of the assailants, and two of these sketches were similar in that the attacker is said to have had blondish hair that had a part. The Donna Loria sketch, however, was markedly different, not only in the shape and features of the face, but as well as the hair. The hair on Loria's attacker, remember this is the first shooting victim, he had dark, curly hair, almost like a perm. So besides the fact that it's New York City and it's very difficult to, you know, link this kind of stuff given the geographic locations of all three shootings at this point, the fact that there are different assailants in these shootings is another reason why the cops were unable to link it. These cases together. Also, you have to take into account that most of the slugs removed from the crime scenes were too deformed to be able to do any form of comparison. Also, too, there really had not been that many serial killer cases in the U.S. at this time. So, it's highly unlikely that police would know that they needed to, you know, be looking for this type of thing when they're looking at various shooting cases. And the serial killer cases that had happened in the U.S. I can't think of any off the top of my head that had involved firearms up to this point. At around 12:40 a.m. on January 30th, 1977, 26-year-old Christine Freund and her fiancé, 30-year-old John Deal, were sitting in Deal's Firebird near the Forest Hills terminal for the Long Island Railroad. They were preparing to go to a local disco after having left a movie theater, at which point they had seen the movie Rocky. January 30th was a fairly cold night. Anybody who has ever been in a major city during the winter understands what I'm saying when I say that winter in the cities is hell, as the wind, which is already frigid, is coming off of the nearby waterfronts and it barrels down the avenues and streets like a wind tunnel, so that no matter what it is you're wearing, it cuts right through your clothing to the bone. So Deal and Freund were understandably sitting inside the car, huddled together, waiting for it to warm up enough for them to drive off. Now, according to Deal in a statement he later gave to police, Christine said, "God, it's cold," at which point the windows in the car shattered as someone opened fire on it. Specifically, the passenger side window was blown out. Christine was hit by the first shot. The second shot hit her in the shoulder and traveled into her back, while the other smashed into the windshield. Deal and Christine remained huddled into the car until it was over, at which point Deal pushed Christine back into her seat and realized that she was seriously wounded. He jumped out of the car and began running around the neighborhood screaming for people to help him, that his girlfriend had been shot. One couple drove him back to the car, and when he went to look into the car to check on Christine, they drove off. Approaching other people, they continued walking. One neighbor heard him screaming from the street and called the police, while Deal got back into his Firebird and took off. He ended up parking in the middle of an intersection in order to halt traffic, thus ensuring that help would come to them. Christine Freund was taken to the hospital, and she died at 4:10 a.m. in St. John's Hospital. Her official cause of death was a bullet wound to the head. And this is a pivotal crime in the Son of Sam murders, because this is the crime that galvanized the police to the idea that they had a serial killer in their midst, as they were able to identify the bullets as having come from a .44 caliber Charter Arms Bulldog. And in fact, the Daily News the next day, February 1st, announced that, quote, "More than 50 detectives are investigating possible links between the murder of Christine Freund in Forest Hill, Queens, early Sunday, and three episodes last year. Two in Queens and one in the Bronx." Again, it is important to note here that the 1970s, especially in a major city, was much different than our world today. News did not travel so fast, and serial killers were a largely unknown commodity to both police and the general public. Were a series of shootings to happen like this today, it's more probable than not that the police would be fairly quick to link them together. Even though they were in different precincts, they still share data, and someone would have seen the similarities in the slayings and pointed it out long beforehand. The composite sketches from the three earlier shootings were released to the public, and New York Police Department Sergeant Richard Conlin is on the record as stating that the police were looking for multiple suspects, not just one. Again, that is important for, as anybody who knows this case is aware, only one man ended up taking the rap for these crimes, but back in early 77, the police realized that they had more than one shooter involved, which they would do an about-face on when Berkowitz was taken into custody. Now, Tuesday, March 8th, 1977, at roughly 7 o'clock, an unnamed 18-year-old left her Forest Hill, Queens home with her 13-year-old brother. The two of them were out for an evening jog. While she was running, she noticed a young man standing in a playground area at the corner of Continental and Dartmouth. This young woman would later state that he stared at her in an eerie, threatening manner. The man was described as having wavy dark hair combed straight back, and his hands were jammed into the pocket of his beige raincoat. He stood about 6 feet tall, weighing roughly 175 pounds. This unknown individual had frightened another girl moments beforehand, and as this unnamed woman was running, she felt a sense of unease at the way the man was staring at her. After passing by the man, this unnamed young woman and her brother turned onto a few different streets before ending up on Exeter and 70th Street, where she again saw the man who had been standing in the playground, and he was staring at her. After passing the man, the woman turned around and saw him walking east towards Exeter and Tennis Plates and Dartmouth. This was nearing 7:30. 19-year-old Virginia Voxesian, a student at Columbia University, was walking down Continental toward Dartmouth Avenue, taking the same route that her unnamed neighbor had taken roughly 20 minutes beforehand. Nearing 4 Dartmouth Street, Virginia became aware of a short, youngest-looking individual wearing a watch, cap, and sweater who was approaching her from the opposite direction. As they passed each other, this individual removed a gun and pointed it in Virginia's face. Virginia, in an act of desperation, threw her hands up in front of her face, with holding her school books in an attempt to block off the coming shot. Unfortunately, the bullet tore through the textbooks and hit Virginia in the face. Further down the block, a witness saw the individual run away from the shooting, and the killer ran by a witness. And upon seeing the witness, the killer cried out, "Oh Jesus," before pulling the cap down over their face and continuing on. This witness described the individual as being only 16 to 18 years of age, stocky build, clean shaven, wearing a ski jacket or sweater and a cap, which was either brown or blue and striped. The shooter appeared to be about 5'7". This particular shooting of Virginia is one of the ones that is used as the basis for the idea that there are multiple shooters in the Son of Sam killing, in that the sketch that would be made from witness statements does not match David Berkowitz in any way, shape, or form, and it's kind of infamously become known as Ski Cap. And I will be posting pictures of these sketches up on Instagram as well as MeWe and Facebook for you to see them. And you'll see the differences in appearance. Unfortunately, Virginia was not able to give any kind of statement regarding her attacker, as she died instantly when she was shot. However, there was fallout from this killing, unlike the others. On March 9th, the day after the shooting, the newspapers reported that the police were looking for a quote-unquote chubby teenager in a ski cap as a prime suspect in this shooting. The papers also reported that the police stated that there was no evidence linking this particular shooting with any of the other ones that had occurred prior to it. The police internally began discussing the fact that they may have a serial shooter, as 44 caliber bullets from a Charter Arms Bulldog were found in at least two or three of the shootings. However, there was no evidence that they could conclusively link any of these bullets as coming from the same gun. You have to remember, these bullets, which had gone into people's bodies and in various areas of their autos, were really deformed, so it was, you know, next to impossible to definitively link these shots from the same gun. You couple this with the fact that they believe that they were looking for at least two and possibly four different suspects from all of these shootings. And you can see that the police department had an arduous task ahead of them. It's difficult enough to find one individual in a city the size of New York. It's next to impossible to find four suspects in that same city. Police did a little bit of an about-face on March 10th, which was 2 days after the Voskresian murder, when both the police and the mayor at the time, Abraham Beam, convened a press conference. And at this conference, they stated that there was a ballistics match between the most recent killing and that of the Loria shooting. They also went on to publicly proclaim that all of the shootings were in fact linked together. This was the first time they had done this, despite the fact that they had been saying since the start of things that, you know, none of these shootings were related, and even stated that after the most recent shooting. So it's a pretty quick turnover where none of these are related and all of a sudden they are. Another interesting tidbit from this press conference was the police, as well as the mayor, went to great lengths to state that the individual who was seen fleeing the scene wearing a ski cap was not, in fact, the shooter. And that is an important fact, as anyone who knows this case is aware only one man would end up being convicted for these crimes. Up till this point, the police were saying, you know, there's more than one individual involved in all of this, and this was a tact that they would continue to take until the cases were solved. In fact, the man that the police were actually looking for was close to 6 feet tall. Remember, Ski Cap was stated as being about 5'7". And as someone who's 5'8", there's a big difference between 5'7", 5'8", and 6 foot. Who had their dark hair combed straight back and was seen wearing a beige raincoat. this person was the one who I talked about earlier, who had frightened the jogger by first appearing in a playground and then, you know, mere moments later, standing on a street corner. And it was at this point that the press really latched a hold of these shootings. I've read some reports stating that you couldn't go a day without seeing some mention or other about the .44 caliber killings in both print and video media. And people were really starting to get worried over this, obviously. You've got some unknown individual or individuals running around New York shooting young couples in cars, seemingly for no reason. The full-blown panic had not set in yet. That would come later. The killer laid low for a period of time until April 17, 1977. A 20-year-old tow truck driver named Alexander Esau and a college student and aspiring actress, Valentina Sirani, who was 18, were sitting in a car that belonged to Esau's brother on the Hutchinson River Parkway service road in the Bronx. They were roughly about a block away from Valentina's home and a few blocks from the Loria shooting. The two of them were making out in the car when someone opened fire from the passenger side. The first two shots hit Valentina in the head, while the next two shots hit Alexander in the head. Valentina was pretty much dead on the scene, while Alexander would linger on for a few hours. A neighbor heard the shots and called the police, who would later say that the weapon was the same one that had been used in the other murders. It's important to note, though, that these were four headshots that were fired, and anyone who has ever fired a gun knows that that kind of shooting takes a significant amount of skill, especially with something like a .44 that has pretty good recoil on it. These were four quick successive shots that were let out, so the individual who did this obviously was used to using a weapon of such a caliber and had enough training and wherewithal to be able to control the gun enough that after the first shot, they were able to fire a second, then a third, then a fourth, and hit two different targets in roughly the exact same area. I want to stress for anybody who's younger that, you know, might be thinking when you shoot a gun, it's, you know, like a video game. When you shoot a handgun, there's quite a bit of recoil. It's nothing like a video game. You have to shoot, pause, readjust your sights, and then fire again if you want to get anywhere close to where you hit the first time. So for somebody to be able to pull this off in such rapid succession shows that whoever it was that did this particular crime knew what they were doing, knew what they were aiming for, and had no problem pulling it off. This particular crime was significant as well as the killer dropped the first known Son of Sam letter at the scene. And it was from this letter, which was addressed to Queens Detective Captain Joseph Borelli, that the moniker, or the nom de plume of Son of Sam, would be born. This was a fact that the police tried to hold close to their chest, although 2 days later, it would be revealed through sources within the New York Police Department that a letter had been left, and that the killer had claimed that they would strike again. The police noted that the letter was written in stylized slanting block letters, and that the person who wrote it was trying to affect a Scottish accent. I'm going to read what has become known as the Borelli letter. I am deeply hurt by your calling me a Weemon hater. I am not, but I am a monster. I am the son of Sam. I am a little brat. When Father Sam gets drunk, he gets mean. He beats his family. Sometimes he ties me up to the back of the house. Other times he locks me in the garage. Sam loves to drink blood. Go out and kill, commands Father Sam. Behind our house, some rest, mostly young, raped and slaughtered. Their blood drained, just bones now. Papa Sam keeps me locked in the attic, too. I can't get out, but I look out the attic window and watch the world go by. I feel like an outsider. I am on a different wavelength than everybody else, programmed to kill. However, to stop me, you must kill me. Attention all police. Shoot me first. Shoot to kill, or else. Keep out of my way or you will die. Papa Sam is old now. He needs some blow to preserve his youth. He has had too many heart attacks. Too many heart attacks. Ugh, me hoot. It hurts me, sonny boy. I miss my pretty princess most of all. She's resting on Our Lady's house, but I'll see her soon. I am the monster, Beelzebub, the chubby behemoth. I love to hunt, prowling the streets looking for fair game, tasty meat. The women of Queens are the prettiest of all. I must be the water they drink. I live for the hunt, my life, blood for Papa. Mr. Borelli, sir, I don't want to kill anymore, no sir. No more, but I must honor thy father. I want to make love to the world. I love people. I don't belong on earth. Return me to Yahoos, to the people of Queens. I love you, and I want to wish all of you a happy Easter. May God bless you in this life and in the next. And for now, I say goodbye and good night. Police, let me haunt you with these words. I'll be back. I'll be back. To be interpreted as bang, 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 yours in murder, Mr. Monster. As I had said, this letter was withheld from the public, although the police did allow certain aspects of it to leak out through various media sources, and it was because of this that the term the 44 caliber killer was replaced with the name Son of Sam. During the ensuing weeks, the police department set up a task force made up of around 150 different officers and detectives. One of these detectives I am fairly familiar with, that's a guy by the name of Joe Coffey. If you've ever seen pictures of him from the time period, he almost looks like Clint Eastwood's character Dirty Harry, with the high back swept hair, and he has a very distinctive way of talking. And I'm singling Coffey out because he's one of the few officers that has publicly stated he believes that Berkowitz did it by himself. And to be honest, Coffey is a fairly arrogant individual. I've read his book, The Coffey Files, and watched numerous interviews with him, and Coffey says in not so many words, what he says is how things are, and that's the end of it, and any discussion outside of that is wrong, and anyone who thinks along those lines is a fool and not worthy of his, you know, attention. So to be blunt, he's really an arrogant motherfucker, and a lot of the cops, the detectives that were involved in this case, were cut from the same cloth. They were real hard-nosed badasses, and they would do things, you know, the police today would never, ever be able to get away with. There's an interview clip floating around from the night Berkowitz was arrested where one of the lead detectives on camera pretty much threatens a member of the press that you know, if you ask a question along this line again, you and I can go out back, and I'll have you thrown the hell out of here. He doesn't say it in so nice a manner. It's filled with expletives, and the threat is, you know, heavily implied in his words and his tone. So these are the kind of people that were hunting for the Son of Sam at this period. Individuals who almost seemed to see themselves as infallible and that their shit didn't stink, and who kind of seemed to hold the populace in some form of contempt. And that contempt extended to the media, as you will see momentarily. On May 26th, they released a new psychological profile of the killer. It described him as neurotic, schizophrenic, and paranoid, while also asserting that the killer might believe themselves to be a victim of demonic possession. They really weren't making any headway on the case, however. The one thing they were doing was an attempt to trace down the 56 or so Charter Arms Bulldogs that were registered in New York City. And they eventually did do this, test firing all of them, but unfortunately, it did not reproduce the results they were hoping for, as none of the guns matched the ballistics from the bullets that they had. To show you how much the police were really grasping at straws, they actually tried to trace down all of the Charter Arms Bulldogs that had been sold throughout the United States. The number was somewhere in the neighborhood of 28,000, which right there should tell you that's completely unrealistic to think you're going to be able to locate the owners of every one of these guns. They had also placed decoys in parked cars throughout the city in an attempt to try and lure the killer out. Unfortunately, however, they were not able to spur the killer into action. They next heard from the Son of Sam killer on May 30th, which was Memorial Day, when a letter was mailed from Englewood, New Jersey, whereas the previous letter had been sent to the police department, this one was sent to a reporter by the name of Jimmy Breslin. Breslin was a pretty loud, brash man. From everything that I have seen, though, he was at least entertaining, and he was well known throughout New York for the stories that he wrote. In fact, he wrote a number of columns on the Son of Sam case and was tied into the Omega Task Force, which was the official name of the Son of Sam Task Force, meaning he had a lot of friends who were in the task force that would give him tips and information. The letter was actually mailed to Jimmy Breslin, care of the New York Daily News, and the paper, you know, put out hints that they had received this letter in subsequent columns in order to, you know, stir up the public's interest and build circulation for the day when they did publish the letter. And the police, upon the release of this letter, let their contempt for the journalists in New York be known, believing that it should not have been released. This letter really set off the frenzy that would become known as the quote-unquote Summer of Sam. And one thing that's important to note is that the Breslin letter was much different from the letter that had been left at the previous crime scene, in that whoever wrote the letter had a much better grasp of the written language. And you'll see that when I read it to you in a moment. It was almost as though somebody who wrote for a living penned this particular letter. So here goes. Hello from the gutters of NYC, which are filled with dog manure, vomit, stale wine, urine, and blood. Hello from the sewers of NYC, which swallow up these delicacies when they are washed away by the sweeper trucks. Hello from the cracks in the sidewalks of NYC and from the ants that dwell in these cracks and feed on the dried blood of the dead that has seeped into these cracks. JB, I'm just dropping you a line to let you know that I appreciate your interest in these recent and horrendous 44 killings. I also want to tell you that I read your column daily and I find it quite informative. Tell me, Jimmy, what will you have for July 29th? You can forget about me if you like, because I don't care for publicity. However, you must not forget Donna Loria, and you cannot let the people forget her either. She was a very, very sweet girl, but Sam's a thirsty lad, and he won't let me stop killing until he gets his fill of blood. Mr. Breslin, sir, don't think that because you haven't heard from me for a while that I went to sleep. No, rather, I am still here, like a spirit roaming the night. Thirsty, hungry, seldom stopping to rest, anxious to please Sam. I love my work. Now the void has been filled. Perhaps we shall meet face to face someday, or perhaps I will be blown away by cops with smoking 38s. Whatever. If I shall be fortunate enough to meet you, I will tell you all about Sam if you like, and I will introduce you to him. His name is Sam the Terrible. Not knowing what the future holds, I shall say farewell and I will see you at the next job. Or should I say, you will see my handiwork at the next job? Remember, Mrs. Loria. Thank you. In their blood and from the gutter, Sam's creation, 44. Here are some names to help you along. Forward them to the inspector for use by NCIC. The Duke of Death, the Wicked King Wicker, the 22 Disciples of Hell, John Wheaties, rapist and suffocator of young girl. P.S. JB, please inform all the detectives working the slayings to remain. P.S. JB, please inform all the detectives working the case that I wish them the best of luck. Keep 'em digging, drive on, think positive, get off your butts, knock on coffins, etc. Upon my capture, I promise to buy all the guys working on the case a new pair of shoes if I can get up the money. Son of Sam. The letter was signed with a very unique symbol beneath the Son of Sam. It was an X with crosses and the symbol for male and female sticking out of it, as well as a T and an S. On the back of the envelope, in the same block-style lettering, was written Blood and Family, Darkness and Death, Absolute Depravity, 44. It was noted that this letter had a few distinct characteristics to it that the other letter did not possess. It had centering as well as hanging indentations, which would be characteristic of somebody who worked in the graphics field. There was a bit of a panic among the public upon the publication of this letter, and the police were swarmed with tips as people sought to turn individuals in who they believed fit the description of the various names given at the end of the letter. However, the police were no closer to catching the Son of Sam than they had been at the start of the investigation. We're going to leave it here this week. Next week, we'll dive back into the case with the next series of shootings. Again, if you enjoy the show, please like and subscribe on your favorite podcast website, share on social media, tell your friends, tell your families, leave a 5-star review. Until next week, I am Ian Totten. This is the Deathcast. Stay morbid.